I would caution that a lot of what we label disruption and what startups talk about as being disruptive is not really disruptive. It is what Clayton Christensen once called sustaining innovation. It's making something better. And no shame, absolutely nothing wrong with it, because 99% of stuff which is happening in the world is exactly that. And that's fine. That's great. You can build incredible businesses making something which is, you know, better. It's not deeply disruptive. I mean, look at a Tesla. A Tesla is still a car. It looks like a car. It just, you know, is better because it runs on batteries and, you know, like they've got all these like interesting properties, etc. But it's still a car. It still looks like a car. It still gets you from A to B and a thing which looks like a car.
Welcome to a new episode of The Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian, and today we're talking about disruption. And we're talking about how to identify markets that are ready for disruption. I think that's especially important for every entrepreneur starting out, but also expanding the product sections that you work on. And then we're also talking about how do I understand the least protected part about my business model? How do I defend myself against disruption, and how do I prepare myself? And today's guest is Pascal Finette. Pascal is the founder of Be Radical, where they're working with a lot of organizations on defending themselves against disruption, but while transforming the companies and the business models. And you wrote a book, Disrupt Disruption. So I'm very happy to have you on the show and talk to you about identifying what we could focus on, then also deciding what we should focus on, and then how the step-by-step process could look like. Happy to have you on the show.
Fabian, thanks so much for having me, and can't wait to dig into this.
Let's start with the first definition, I think. Before we come to the book, what is disruption? I think a lot of people are throwing the word here and there, and everybody's like, yeah, disruption, I need to disrupt anything, and I'm disrupting the market. What does disruption actually mean?
It's a really good question, and it's really also the starting point for the journey we took with the book. About 4 years ago, I got just really dissatisfied with the way we think about disruption. Quite frankly, quite annoyed. And you just mentioned, like, we love to throw this term around. You can't read a business headline which doesn't say, you know, disruption this, disruption that. For me, it has become like tofu. Tofu, of course, this soy-based stuff you eat in the Asian cuisine, tastes like absolutely nothing. And then you put sauce on it, tastes like the sauce. And disruption has the same moniker. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Make no mistake, when we talk about disruption, we're truly standing on the shoulders of giants, people like Clayton Christensen, who defined this term, disruptive innovation. And what we found is, and the way we like to think about disruption really is, we have this theory around what we call state changes. So the interesting insight for us was when we started thinking about disruption and you start peeling the layers of the onion, you realize that the underlying consumer need, the thing the consumer hires a product or service for them to do, is actually really stable over really long periods of time. So classic disruption story, of course, like Kodak, everybody knows that, or Blockbuster, Nokia, etc. And you think Kodak, you're still taking pictures, right? You still, like, as a matter of fact, you take way more pictures than ever before. They just don't come, they come in a different way. So the interesting insight for us is to start this disruption journey with an acknowledgement of the fact that the underlying consumer need in your business actually does not change. What does change is the particularities of how you deliver this. And there's a beautiful quote, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, about 10 years ago at the Amazon Recode conference on stage said, you know, I get this question all the time. It's like, what's coming in the next 10 years? What's new in 10 years? And he said, you know, that's an interesting question, but really the more interesting question is, what is not going to change in the next 10 years? Because that's what we build our businesses on. And then he goes on to, like, in a very, like, very Jeff Bezos style, very humorous way. He said, think about Amazon. Like, Amazon is known for low prices, fast delivery. And he's like, I have a really hard time imagining a future 10 years from now where someone comes to me and says, Jeff, I love Amazon. I just wish you would be a little bit more expensive, or you would deliver my goods a little slower, right? So really starting to think about and understanding what is the consumer need you actually fulfill, and then think about what is the state you're currently in, like what is the way you do this, and what is a potential future state? And this is where disruption then comes from, when these states change, when they flip.
I think there are so many things that I could have in mind when I'm delivering a product. There might be 10 different ways how it could be changed in the future. So how do I approach this while not like over being over frightened of like, oh, disruption could be, or like also chasing every opportunity? How do I identify which part of that could be changed and which is like the most useful way of thinking about it and approaching things?
I mean, look at what you're doing with the podcast, right? 20 years ago, this wouldn't have been possible at all. And the way you would have delivered this would be, I don't know, a radio show, television, a book, you know, whatever it is. The interesting thing is 20 years ago, entrepreneurs still wanted to have that kind of information. They still wanted to learn from other people, etc. So what we did is we wrote books about this stuff. Or, you know, when the internet came along and we had the first blogs, we started blogging about it. So in many ways, again, the underlying consumer need, the need you'll fulfill for an entrepreneur to learn about business, to get ideas, be inspired, etc., that is not changing. It's been consistent for decades. What is changing is the particular way you do it. And what I would encourage everybody to do is to think about, when you understand what is it I'm actually doing, thinking about what is the current way of doing it. And, you know, in our case, it might be a podcast. And then thinking about what could be a potential future way of doing this. And this is where I think it's really interesting, because from a futurist perspective, which is really where, you know, a lot of our work comes from, you can see these early indicators of change, the thin wisps of tomorrow, if you just look carefully. So again, currently, without a doubt, the number one topic you see is ChatGPT. So this AI, which is trained on like massive amount of text and language, which becomes essentially contextually aware and becomes conversational. I could imagine that, again, talking about, you know, delivering insights to entrepreneurs, that there will be a version of ChatGPT, which is trained on a body of work, which is, you know, entrepreneurial wisdom, startup wisdom, etc., so that as an entrepreneur, I can actually have a conversation, a direct conversation with this model, right? So again, same consumer need, different delivery. So what I encourage people to do is to really think about what is coming down the pike. What do you see on the horizon as a new ways of doing things? And then thinking about, how could I leverage this to better serve the consumer need I have identified for myself?
That's fair. But my question comes from a point where I'm like, okay, we have, let's say, the few huge topics that we're discussing are blockchain. Even when the crypto crashes, definitely pushed it away a bit back. Then we have artificial intelligence, as you mentioned. Then we have the metaverse and AR, VR. And all of them could bring different versions of changing what I'm doing. And I think for most of the people out there, it could be artificial intelligence or blockchain. For some, it's AI. And for the others, it's AR, VR. Or the metaverse. But how do I, like, do I have to put all of my eggs in one basket and just focus on one? Do I try out or build teams for 2 to 3 different technical changes? How do I identify the thing that I'm going after and that's the most relevant to my business model?
That's a great question. And I think it comes down to essentially two big things. The one is your ability to assess how real a particular technology is and how mature it is and how close to real market value it is. And this has a lot to do for me to like your ability to unpack what a technology is made of. Because, you know, we talk about the metaverse, for example. The metaverse doesn't exist. It's, you know, like software, it's headsets, it's tooling, you know, a whole bunch of other things. So understanding how far along are we with those things, and then getting a better sense of how much longer until this becomes real and thus, you know, deployable. So that's a starting point, I think, where you assess like what's happening. Then understanding what are the surrounding factors, you know, like societal acceptance, etc. So I always cringe, you know, this is my personal like soapbox here, when we talk about virtual reality, which I have a lot of respect for, and I think there's lots of really interesting stuff happening in VR. At the same time, when I hear people telling me, oh, you know, like imagine you could watch the Soccer World Cup, you know, wearing your VR headset and you're like on the soccer pitch, that sounds pretty amazing. At the same time, thinking about the way I enjoy watching the Soccer World Cup is with a bunch of friends, you know, kicking back, drinking a beer, having some potato chips, you know, imagining us now sitting in like a virtual reality, like headset world where we're all like tethered and like, no, we can't see each other. You barely can like get the can of beer to your mouth because you can't see it. Like, they have a really hard time, right? So allowing yourself to actually think about like, you know, what is the usability of this stuff? Like, what does it actually look like? So I think it's really important to do that first, to get a good sense of where is the technology. And again, you mentioned blockchain is a really nice example. I used to be at Singularity University, this interesting like think tank and learning organization out of Silicon Valley. And like 6, 7, 8 years ago, when the blockchain first came around, I remember tons and tons of startups coming to me. It's like, oh, the blockchain is going to change everything. It's going to be like the future, et cetera, which it might or might not be. But 7 years ago, the technology was clearly not matured enough that as a startup, I would have made my bet on it. Because, you know, startups only have so much money typically and have only so much runway. So you need to make your bets. So that's number one. And once you have identified something, say, for example, you say, well, VR is for us or AR or, you know, AI or whatever. Then I think it's really about your ability to prototype and really quickly prototype and increase your rate of learning. So this goes, you know, like the agility idea, which is funny because a lot of people talk about it. I see not that many people actually doing it really, really well. There's much to unpack here, but the shortest version I can give you here is really asking yourself when you look at an experiment you want to run, becoming clear what you actually want to experiment. So the scientific method, what's the question you actually want to answer? Instead of just like, oh, let's try this out and see what happens. And then 3 months later, you've spent oodles of time and energy on building something, but you haven't really learned anything because you don't even know what the question was. So becoming clear about what the question is. And then the second one is trying to find the answer to the question of, is this truly the cheapest, easiest, quickest way to try something out? Because, you know, I'm a technologist by training and by heart. I know this really well. I love sitting down and just hacking stuff together. And then 3 days later, I've built like this prototype, which I honestly could have validated by using an online service and just paying $10 for it within, you know, 2 minutes. But so really getting really good at trying things out and increasing your rate of learning, which then kind of like gets you to like kind of stumbling forward into the future. A friend of mine once called the way we move as entrepreneurs in the future, he called this the drunken walk of the entrepreneur. Because it's really what it is, right? It's like there's no straight line. It's just like you sway left and right by trying out and learning.
What role does the past play while identifying and such opportunities and looking into the future?
It's an interesting question. I think there's much to be learned from the past, and I think it's a criminal offense if you're not taking the past into the account. At the same time, it's also very easy to look at something in the past and say it didn't work, it doesn't work, right? It's a classic like big business answer when you're in a meeting and, you know, someone comes up with an idea and says like, oh, we should try this out. And then someone says like, oh, I remember last year we tried this, it doesn't work, it will never work. So be careful, use the past as a guidance, use the past as a, what can we learn and see if you can extract patterns from it. So a beautiful example I love to talk about, and you know, this is where I out myself, I'm like clearly a little older. I remember when the original Palm Pilot came out, which was this like personal digital assistant, 1996. And it's kind of funny because I recently bought one on eBay. And you look at the device and it looks an awful lot like an iPhone. You know, it has a touchscreen, has apps, you know, all kinds of stuff. The form factor is similar to an iPhone. It took 11 years until Steve Jobs finally brought out the iPhone. But thinking about, if you think about this as an episode and thinking about what can we learn from this? You know, like there's learnings in there, which is a lot of people dismissed the Palm Pilot as just a toy. A lot of people didn't have the vision that one day you could put the internet on this thing. A lot of people didn't understand the power of apps and an app store, a centralized app store around this, right? So there's lots you can learn and patterns you can like extract and then bring those into the future. And at the same time, be very careful to look at these things and not say, oh, I remember this thing, it was crap, like it's, you know, this is the same thing as back in the day. It's a double-edged sword, I would say.
I think there are two or three things to be learned from this, so it can be helpful to look at the past to see what hasn't worked and ask yourself if the time is right now. And so therefore, the second thing is timing matters. Without the right timing, it will be super, super hard. And sometimes you have to question yourself if you're looking at the past, if you're trying to justify things the wrong way, like saying, oh, it hasn't worked in the past, therefore it shouldn't work now, without really iterating on the decision. If you come to the same conclusion while really analyzing the situation, then that's fair. But if you just say, oh, it hasn't worked in the past, then that's why it doesn't work now, then you're betraying yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's an interesting question my friends over at Google X like to ask this when they look at, you know, a technology, a behavior change, whatever. They very often ask themselves and try to be as honest as possible about this question is, can we envision a future where this will not be true? And if you say, well, you know, honestly, I have no problem envisioning a future where this isn't true, then you don't have a thing. A good example for this for me is in the first dot-com boom, like in the mid-90s, there was a company called Webvan, which raised billions of dollars to do grocery delivery. It did not work at all in, 1995, because internet wasn't there, e-commerce wasn't there, infrastructure wasn't there, blah, 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 blah. But there's an interesting question, which is, in 1995, you could have asked, even after they went bankrupt, you could have asked yourself, can I envision a future where we will not have grocery delivery? And the answer is, clearly, yes, of course. Like, there will be a world where your groceries will just show up at the doorsteps. Of course. And the question is then, when? And what do we need to have in place in terms of infrastructure and tools and whatever for that to be true?
I really like the question, because I think a lot of founders could iterate way earlier on what they're working on if they're not like, what if it was true that this could be part of the world, instead of, can we think about a world where this does not exist? Because often enough, and I think existing also means for a subset of people, it doesn't have to be for everyone. So don't get this wrong, because it's easy to say, yeah, but it's only for, let's say, 1 million people instead of the whole world. But if it's there and if it's part of their lives, then it's existing. So saying everything for some people does not exist and they will never use it is a different story. But especially for your target audience, can we envision a world where this does not exist? So when do we decide, or especially let's go to the process of you working with larger corporates and larger clients. When is a signal for, okay, here's a market, here's a technology that we need to act on, otherwise we are getting disrupted. When is it strong enough to really execute on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about this earlier. It's like there's a technological component to it, which is it needs to be mature enough, it needs to be robust enough, it needs to be scalable enough, etc. And I would postulate that if you look carefully and you take your own bias for hype out of it, you actually have a really good chance of like assessing this. I believe the other factor is really a market acceptance and a utility factor. So classic, in the disruption world, there's a classic story of Blockbuster here in the United States, which was a VHS video cassette rental store chain. And there's some interesting learnings in the Blockbuster story. I mean, granted, that story has been told a million times, but if you think about Blockbuster, at the height of the Blockbuster empire, they had like 9,000 stores all across the United States. Famously, there was a Blockbuster within 10 minutes if you lived in urban America. They opened a new Blockbuster every 18 hours. So incredible. Their state, what they did is home entertainment in a VHS video cassette, which you get from a store. And here's where it gets interesting. And I think this is important for both incumbents, existing companies, as well as new startups to learn. You get really good as a company in your particular state. So Blockbuster knew better than anyone else where to place one of those stores, how to merchandise it, how to run it, etc. So you can make the same argument about Starbucks or McDonald's in the food space. Now the state changed and you get to a DVD. And the DVD is nice because better video quality, audio quality, better longevity, etc. But you also can solve an interesting problem, which is you can put the DVD into an envelope. I can ship it to your house. Now I solve two problems for you. One is even if it's 10 minutes to Blockbuster, it's 10 minutes, right? One way. So you go 10 minutes to Blockbuster, you spend 20 minutes in the store to find what you want to watch, and then you bring the DVD or the VHS video cassette back home 40 minutes later. And then you need to return it. So it's kind of awful. The second one is a local store can only have so many of a particular movie. So very often when you want to watch something, it wasn't there. Now, if I run a mail order company, I can solve these two problems. I can ship it to your mailbox. So all you need to go is you need to go to your mailbox. And B, I run a centralized inventory. So I can have much better inventory control. So I can make sure that you get to see what you want to see when you want to see it. And this is where it gets interesting, because now the state changed. And when the state changed overnight, your existing skills and processes become obsolete. So think about Blockbuster. They're really good at running stores. That doesn't matter anymore. And I think the invitation is, again, like if you're an incumbent, prepare yourself for it. But the invitation for a startup is, and I talk to a lot of founders about this, is when they look at their particular market, typically you're not opening a new market. Typically you're not creating something which wasn't there before, like create a whole new consumer need. You're typically replacing something which is there. You make something better, and there's nothing wrong with that. Asking yourself when you do that, is this industry going through a change? And if the industry is going through a change, is the change so dramatic that the incumbents, the old companies' skills and processes might become obsolete? If that is happening, you've got a massive opening. And that's where we see industries shift, like you go from Blockbuster to Netflix. So my invitation is always look for those changes, because there are these fractures in the fabric of time are really fascinating and super interesting for companies to to go through. And I would say we see a lot of them, right? You mentioned blockchain, AI, AR, VR, all of them will lead to these interesting changes.
You mentioned that you worked at Google X. So now a question regarding the companies that you looked at as well. So how many of the startups that you're talking to right now, but also back in the bit more in the innovation and VC part, how many of the companies are actually working on disruptive stuff where you're like, okay, or not only companies, startups, how many of them seeking investment are actually working on stuff that should get invested in?
It should get invested in. I don't know. I mean, they will tell you every single one of them, no doubt. I would caution, we started our conversation talking about disruption and how I like liking it to tofu. I would caution that a lot of what we label disruption and what startups talk about as being disruptive is not really disruptive. It is what Clayton Christensen once called sustaining innovation. It's making something better. And no shame, absolutely nothing wrong with it, because 99% of stuff which is happening in the world is exactly that. And that's fine. That's great. You can build incredible businesses making something which is, better. It's not deeply disruptive. I mean, look at a Tesla. A Tesla is still a car. It looks like a car. It just, is better because it runs on batteries and, they've got all these like interesting properties, etc. But it's still a car. It still looks like a car. It still gets you from A to B in a thing which looks like a car. So disruptive? I don't know. It's disruptive if you have a combustion engine manufacturer, but really to the consumer, it's still a car. So it's just a sustaining innovation. So I would argue most of the startups we see, they're actually doing sustaining innovation, which is totally fine. To answer your question, like how many of those should get funding? For me, the question is always, are you creating a significant enough change in your customer's value? And if that's the case, by all means, please, like go ahead. This is amazing and it should be funded and it should it should exist. There's a decent amount of startups, I would say, where we might talk about we're creating that change, that substantial change, but it feels more of a swapping out of the technology with the kind of the same end result, right? It's like, oh, like it's like this, but with a little bit more AI, but it doesn't really change anything. Like let's do table reservation systems for customers, but it's fully AI powered. I'm like, sure, great, but it's still the same thing. So I don't know what the percentage is of those companies, but I would encourage everybody to really think hard about how do I increase the value we give to our customers? How do we make their lives better, faster, cheaper, whatever dimension you tackle, and really focus on that. And as long as you focus on that, you're fine.
I wanted to be a bit provocative, of course, but I think what we definitely could see here is that there is that the mindset at least has to be how do I deliver the most for the customer from a value perspective, and not only how can I label my company as very innovative and therefore think about okay, how can I leverage technology, new possibilities, etc., to really deliver more value to the customer. And that's honestly all that matters. And if it's just like 5% better than everything that's out there, and it might not be worth the time, the money, etc., invested in building a business over the years. It could be if you think that's fair, and sometimes it could not be, but you have to look at this very clearly and think, hey, what about my resources? Do I really want to invest them here? Because a lot of founders are just like taking their first idea and want to run with it. And of course, if they do it long enough, they will pivot over time if they want to be successful, because most of the times it's not the first idea and the first thinking about a problem, but also sometimes it has to be a completely different problem that you could work on, that you could choose to solve. And therefore, I think that's very, very important mindset shift for a lot of founders.
Yeah, and I would add to this, I love the way you summarize this. And let me add to this, I think it's also really important to understand what is the perceived value on your customer side. Because you might say, well, listen, like we make something 10% better and that's incredible. But if your customer doesn't value those 10%, it doesn't matter, right? On the flip side of that, sometimes you've got customers, they value like the smallest iteration. I used to run on a fairly high level and I was very serious about my running. And in my circles, if Nike brings out a shoe, which makes me on a half marathon time, 10 seconds faster on the whole time, which is nothing on like, on a kilometer basis, I would buy that shoe because it matters to me. So really asking yourselves, like, what is the, not just what is your perceived like betterment, but ask your clients, like, what is the threshold for you to switch? Because again, like in most cases, we're not giving them something which is completely new, which by the way is really hard to do because you need to like form new habits, new behaviors, etc. But we're replacing something that they're doing already. And then the question becomes, how good does it need to be for them to consider the shift? Because there's shifting costs, there's changing costs and shifting costs involved with that.
I think that you could also learn a lot from here when you look at, okay, a shoe that makes me 10 seconds faster. You could also like think, okay, what will be better for a marathon runner or half marathon? Okay, it could be that the shoe is lighter, or it could be that this is this and that, but you have to find out what is the one key metric or the one key benefit that somebody really wants to have, because there are so many benefits that you could optimize for that people don't really care about. And that's what you said, but especially with this example, you could label it better, because for a lot of people it's just like, oh yeah, we're making this more efficient, but it's not the crucial thing that people would love to pay more for or would love to change their behavior for or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I learned from Nicole Glaros, actually, who is she runs Techstars here in the United States. She once told me, you need to make the main thing the main thing. And there's an interesting story. So I used to work at Mozilla, the Firefox web browser, and I was at Mozilla when Chrome came out. And what I found so fascinating about the Chrome story, they clearly whipped our backsides. What's really interesting about the Chrome story is when Chrome came out, objectively, it had a whole bunch of features where it was better than Firefox. Better memory management, you know, faster startup time, blah, blah, blah. The only thing they found and talked about as in what matters to the customer is speed. So every single piece of communication they put out, every ad, every press release, whatever, was all about speed. They didn't even talk about all the other 15 things they did. And I think it's so important because as founders, we have a tendency to like to say, hey, this is, you know, like we've done this and this and this and this, and here's where we're good better. And like our UI is better and this is better and this is better. And to the customer, that doesn't matter. And it's also really confusing to the customer. So figuring out what is the main thing. And the main thing is always, always like out of the view of the customer. And then making that main thing the main thing, I think is a really important insight to be gleaned from what you just said.
Absolutely. I think that's so overlooked. A lot of people are talking about features, not benefits. That's general marketing stuff as well here, because I think a lot of people are just like, yeah, we have to explain everything. And that's how people always describe the difference between Android phones and iPhones, how they are marketed, so that they are also marketed to different audiences and different audiences that want different things. So one doesn't have to be necessarily bad, but it just has to also suit your audience, and you have to know who you are serving. And another thing that I would love to add, because we talked a lot about future and a lot about technologies that are developing, I think it also, and we asked the question, can we imagine a future where this is not existing? And when the answer is no, it will definitely exist. Then we also have to think about, okay, we're building the product today, but we also have to imagine where it can end up with this technology. So how, we don't only have to think about what's possible today using AI, for example. We have to think about, okay, in 5 years, what might be possible with AI, and have to act towards that. Because if I'm in the next years building a product on today's standards, everybody else will outpace me. So I think that's something that people often overlook, that they have to think about, okay, I'm building a product that has to be future ready and has to be at the border of innovation and like running the same pace as fast as possible, because otherwise I'm outdated when mass adoption will be here.
I think it's important. You're absolutely right. I think the flip side of that is that you can get into a pattern where you always chase the last version, the latest thing. And that's maybe equally as dangerous, because it's so easy to just go out and say, oh God, like we need to like, you know, ChatGPT is out and now, you know, GPT-4 is out and now we need to like wait for GPT-4.5, whatever. So you end up chasing. And I think there's an important art, and I think it's more art than science, but there's an important art to say, and here's a point in time where we freeze and really build and scale now out from where we are. I see this a lot with founders and their tech stack. You know, so like you go out and like, I don't know, like I remember when like Python was like the latest and greatest and everything was built on Django. And then it was like, no, now Node is out. Now everything, we need to rewrite everything in JavaScript. Right. And then we had single page applications and like everything needs to be rewritten in React. And I've seen this many times. It is very possible to like get into this rut of always chasing the latest and thinking you get like gains. And there's a point where you also just have to understand. And again, like, let your customer be your guide, where you see like, well, we're really delivering value to the customer, so we're freezing here for a while. Doesn't mean you freeze forever, but you freeze for a while and basically just focus on scale and delivering value to your customer.
Absolutely. I was more about analyzing what's happening and then also deciding, as we mentioned, if we find something that's valuable that we can implement or should implement, because it will be there at some point, adding it to our process and figuring out how this might make our product better is definitely important, because if that does not happen, then you might also be disrupted. So let's talk a few more minutes about the book, because we now heard that it's for larger corporations that want to defend themselves against disruption, but it's also for people figuring out how to evaluate new opportunities. What was a bit more about the book writing? What's the process of writing such a book where you have to, on one hand, have two sides in mind that are like trying to do the same thing, but for different reasons? How to have two opinions and two characters in mind while writing a book?
Yeah, absolutely. So the starting story for the book was a conversation I had with a friend of mine, Andy Billings, who's at Electronic Arts, the game making company. He's been with the company for a long time, 25 years. And if you know anything about Electronic Arts, it's a giant in the field and has been around for a really long time, 40 years. But I asked Andy, he's like, how do you stay relevant in this super fast moving industry? And he gave me a whole bunch of pointers. And then he ended the conversation with a sentence really like made my ears prick up. He said, you know, when you talk to the people on the front lines, they tell you this whole innovation disruption thing looks like nothing they write about in the books. And I felt like that's right, because it really feels that way. It's like, you know, I've read all the books and they're great, make no mistake, but they don't feel like it's what really happens in the trenches of this stuff, be it as a startup or as an incumbent. We then set out to interview these people. We interviewed more than 300 people, very similar to you, a bunch of those we have published on our podcast, and asked them a simple question. We said, like, tell us what you do. Like, don't give me the theory or like, you know, like the PowerPoints. Tell me what you do on the day to day. And what you see very, very quickly when it comes to this topic around innovation and disruption, and I think it's, by the way, it's true for many topics in our community, it's a double-sided coin, because, you know, like, the on one hand, if you're an incumbent, you can use it to kind of protect yourself and to stay relevant. And on the flip side of that, you can look at it and say, well, like, it allows me to see weaknesses in the system and attack them. So that's the beauty, I think, why I think the book kind of works for both sides. It was originally written for the big corporations and the leaders in those corporations. But really, like, when you read it, you see, man, wait a second, like, this gives me a blueprint of like, how do I attack an industry? And I'm a big fan of, like, you know, may the better party win. So, you know, let them battle it out.
Yeah, I think that's always interesting to follow. And as I'm more the startup guy, I also love the smaller parties taking their bite off the cake. But often, as we can see, often the startups just take a part of the cake and not the whole cake. So, but there are other examples, as we explained earlier, or you explained. So therefore, that's definitely fun to see. I will definitely link to the book in the show notes, because I can imagine that it's interesting for a lot of people out there reading, everyone listening, because we always can sharpen our sense for what is the next thing we could tackle, or should we already tackle it? Should we defend ourselves against it to understand it and to, let's say, weaponize this knowledge to then also use it in your company? So therefore, I will link to it. I'll definitely recommend reading your newsletter, listening to your podcast, because there's a lot of content that you're producing as well that I really enjoy. And I can imagine that a lot of people out there would enjoy or will enjoy it as well. Pascal, I would love to end this with a few last words from your side, because I can imagine that you have to tell a large audience of founders a bit more about one or two things that you're like, this is my last thesis that you should take with you.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, Fabian, is amazing chatting with you. I very distinctly remember meeting you for the first time years and years ago over a coffee in Berlin and being just really impressed by you. So thank you so much for having me on this podcast, on your show. I think the most important thing I can tell people is, and I keep telling this, is this is really interesting, weird way we think about the future, because we think about the future as a singular, right? We use the singular the future, in German, die Zukunft, as if there would be one future. And in the futurist community, we call this the official future. It's the future we tell ourselves. And I think if there's just one thing I want to like people to understand is that the future is something we create. Every single day we create it. There is not a singular future. It is something we envision. It's be it through our startups or in our community or whatever you want to do. It's something we envision. It's a near endless pool of opportunities. And then we manifest this future. So my invitation is to really think about like, you don't have a future. You have many futures. And, you know, again, my invitation for everybody is just like drop the singular, adopt the plural and understand this, like, you know, as a startup founder, you're creating the future and there's not even a singular future for you. Clearly, there's a multitude of futures. So the beauty of the future is we create it. The obligation of the future is we have to create it for ourselves. So with that, just for everybody, just go out there, build what matters. And have fun doing so.
That's definitely a good impulse. Thank you so much. And it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining.
Thank you so much for having me.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Falls dir diese Folge gefallen hat, dann musst du auf jeden Fall mal den Unicorn Bakery WhatsApp Newsletter auschecken. Dort bekommst du ein bis zweimal die Woche von mir entweder eine persönliche Sprachnotiz oder eine Content-Empfehlung, Blogpost, Video etc. für Dinge, die du als Gründer unbedingt wissen, lesen, hören musst.
Am einfachsten ist es, du klickst auf den Link in der Beschreibung und meldest dich an. Ansonsten kannst du auch auf jungunternehmerpodcast.com/newsletter gehen.